From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with journalist James Miller. Miller's book, Democracy is in the Streets, examines the rise of the radical student movement during the 1960s. Also today, I speak with essayist Alice Kahn. Among other things, Kahn is credited with coining the word yuppie. A collection of her humorous essays has just been published under the title My Life as a Gal. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews Digital Duke, a new recording of Ellington Classics on state-of-the-art technology. And television critic David Bianculli discusses how the Iran-Contra hearings come across as daytime TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is James Miller, the author of Democracy is in the Streets, a history of SDS, the most important radical student group of the 1960s. Miller examines the philosophy, politics, and tactics of SDS and the break it caused between the old left and the new left. Miller begins in 1962 with the drafting of the Port Huron Statement, the SDS political manifesto, which he considers one of the pivotal documents in post-war American history. He concludes with the clashes between demonstrators and the police in the 1968 Chicago Convention, whose media coverage, he says, introduced the new left to the American public. Miller is also interested in the legacy of the radical student movement in the New Left. He quotes SDS co-founder Tom Hayden, who in 1977 said, "We ended a war, toppled two presidents, desegregated the South. How could we accomplish so much and have so little in the end?" James Miller is the author of two other books on political theory. He's also a book and music critic for Newsweek magazine and edited the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. His new book is called Democracy is in the Streets. Welcome, Jim, to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
What's the personal significance of this story to you?
Well, I began the book about 4 years ago at the height of the age of Reagan, at a time when almost everybody around me, even if they were my own age, I'm 40, seemed to be eager to forget whatever had happened to them in the 1960s. And it struck me as a participant in some of the events of the 1960s, both political events and cultural events, that there was a period of my history, which was a shared history, that was in danger of slipping into oblivion, of just being forgotten culturally. And this was at a time when Vietnam veterans were being recognized, when the civil rights movement, its accomplishments had been recognized, and I just felt that it was important to look back at the student activism of the 60s and try to put it into some kind of fresh perspective and to save it from this kind of historic oblivion. In fact, I think the only people in the culture 4 years ago who were taking the New Left seriously were neoconservatives, because they needed the New Left as a kind of Manichaean opposite so they could blame all of the excesses of the 60s on the New Left.
There seems to have almost been this group embarrassment about the 60s where people were saying, weren't we naive then? Oh, we thought we'd change the world. We were foolish young idealists. That's not the perspective you've taken in your book.
Well, I've tried not to. I think as I began, it quickly became obvious to me that one of the problems is that most people's stereotypes of the 60s came from 1968, 1969. They came from having watched on television demonstrators in the streets of Chicago clashing with police. Most people, when they thought of the New Left, they thought of the Weathermen. They thought of terrorists blowing themselves up with bombs. Whereas in many ways the most intellectually fertile period of the student movement had come earlier, in the early 60s. And this was a period that had been completely overshadowed by the more violent events later in the decade. And it was a period that was really not very well understood, even by people like myself who had come into the movement later in the 60s. And that's the period I decided to focus on in my book.
You spoke to many of the founders and the leaders of SDS. Were they anxious to go back to that period and talk about it for you?
Well, it varied from person to person. A number of the people in the first generation, the student left really came together in 1962 at the Port Huron Conference, which drafted a manifesto called the Port Huron Statement. And at that time, there was only a handful of people. So this initial generation of people, let's say there were maybe 100 in the whole country, had to be really deeply committed to get involved in politics. It wasn't an in thing to be involved in. So most of them are still involved today in doing various kinds of work related to politics. The most famous person I talk about is Tom Hayden. He's a state assemblyman. Others have ended up being trade union organizers or professors. And their willingness to go back and talk about the past was related to where they are today. For someone like Tom Hayden, it's a very difficult problem because, on the one hand, he's most famous because of what he did in the 60s. Yet, as an elected official, his future political ambitions are in constant jeopardy because of what he did in the 60s. So there was a constant tug, as we would talk, as to what he was going to be willing to remember and how he was going to be willing to remember it,
My guest is Jim Miller, the author of the new book, Democracy is in the Streets, which is a history of SDS and the radical student movement. SDS was basically formed in 1962, and it was really one of the first important groups on the New Left and the first important student group. But it actually came out of what's now called the Old Left, specifically a group called the League for Industrial Democracy.
This shows you how completely esoteric it was. Nobody could remember the acronyms were going around. I mean, SDS originally had come out of a group called SLID, which was really a silly name, because it, although it seemed apropos for a socialist youth group in decline. SLID stood for Student League for Industrial Democracy, and it was the student branch of League for Industrial Democracy, which was an educational organ of aging social democrats centered in New York City. SDS at this point was one of several kinds of groups that had sprung up around the country, connected mainly to universities like the University of Chicago, University of Wisconsin. All of them were trying to make some kind of break with the old left groups, which they saw as attached to Marxism, whether of a communist variety or a social democratic variety. And that's really the intellectual ground on which SDS marked its difference with these older members. And their guru figure was a guy named C. Wright Mills, the sociologist. And they looked to him to try to find a language for creating a Native American kind of radicalism that would break with all the old Marxist formulas, which didn't seem appropriate anymore to America in the midst of the American century.
There was a big conflict over whether the student movement should have autonomy or not. Why was it such a big issue to the students to be independent from this older group that they were initially a part of?
Well, there were some substantive matters at stake. There were disagreements about anti-communism, which was probably the most volatile issue. This was a period in 1961-62, right before John Kennedy would give a speech in 1963 announcing a thaw in relations with the Soviet Union, which would lead to a limited test ban treaty. But it was a period where memories of McCarthyism were still fairly fresh among a lot of people on the left. There were people in the older generation who had vivid memories of having their social democratic organizations infiltrated by communists. There were people who had come out of the Communist Party who still felt betrayed by various things that Joseph Stalin had done, whether it be the Moscow trials or perhaps as recently as the invasion of Hungary in 1956. So that this was a period of great ferment and transition on the international left. And the students felt, in terms of assessing this period, that the Soviet Union was itself in transition, and it was inappropriate to consider to continue to treat the Soviet Union as if it were an expansive imperial power, and that the Cold War formulas of American politics had blocked real progress on arms control and, as a result, on domestic reforms, and that the way to really create a new kind of politics was to get beyond the old Cold War formulas that treated the Soviet Union as if it were the font of all evil in the world. Well, many of the people, the older people on the old left, were appalled by this because, to them, the source of original sin in modern politics was Joseph Stalin. And anybody who wanted to take a different approach, they suspected of being soft on communism. And that was really the issue that I think marked the break in the generations, although it took on a kind of personal and emotional flavor. that made it that was beyond these substantive issues. I mean, the two principals at the Port Huron Conference who got into a very angry debate were Tom Hayden, who was 22, on the one hand, and Michael Harrington, who was 32, on the other hand. And to me, the most striking thing, or one of the most striking moments when I was researching my book, was interviewing Hayden and Harrington separately and having them both independently say, after they'd explained to me in great deal all of these substantive issues, you know, though, it wasn't the substantive issues. It was really a generational conflict. It was Oedipal. We could have debated until we were blue in the face. We never could have reached consensus. We, in the case of Tom Hayden, we needed our autonomy. Just because we wanted to go our own way, we were young, full of energy. We didn't want to have old people telling us what to do.
I want to quote some excerpts of the Port Huron Statement, which is the political manifesto of SDS, written in 1962, which you describe as one of the most important post-war political documents. In one part, they say, in a time of supposed prosperity, you can't rely on empty stomachs for social change. The case for change must be argued as never before. The university is a relevant place for such activities. That seems to be the first place where the case is really made, that the university is a very important place for radical organizing.
Well, these kids saw themselves as young intellectuals. And another place where they disagreed with the old left was in the Marxist faith in the proletariat or the labor movement as a engine of social change and the vehicle of freedom in human history. They thought that had been proven wrong by the course of events. And they thought that insofar as you didn't have a kind of class analysis that was going to provide the agency for change, what they suggested would take its place was a much more intellectualized understanding of a crisis of values, which in the argot that they began to develop, they saw as a crisis in democratic values. And that one of the places where you could find people to articulate that crisis would be the university. You would have intellectuals and disgruntled students who would be articulate enough, well-read enough to be able to make the case in a compelling way and therefore create a kind of leadership for a nascent democratic movement that would quickly move beyond the university, involve many other sectors of society, basically creating a kind of coalition of powerless people, students being also powerless because this was before 18-year-olds had the vote, one of the kind of obvious and often forgotten results of this movement was the 18-year-old vote.
Another thing that struck me in this manifesto was that in several parts, there's an emphasis on fulfillment, on meaning in life, which isn't typical in political documents. Here's a couple of areas where that comes up. One, the goal of man and society should be human independence, a concern with finding a meaning in life that is personally or authentic. Here's another one. Work should involve incentives worthier than money or survival. Do you think that in this political emphasis on finding fulfillment and meaning in life, you also have the roots of the cultural radicalism that was going to spring up a few years later?
Well, I think it is one of the intellectual roots of this, and it's one of the reasons why the cultural kind of protests later in the decade were so easily politicized. It's a very complicated process of cross-pollination in the 60s here. A lot of this language comes from the religious traditions of radicalism that many of the students came out of, whether it be a Catholic pacifism, Quakerism, or some of the Southern civil rights Baptist kind of black backgrounds. At the same time, existentialism was very in vogue in university campuses in the late 50s, so a lot of these people were running around reading Camus and very interested in finding the meaning of life that is personally authentic and decided that politics was an appropriate arena in which to try to find such a meaning. So these kinds of formulas, once they got mobilized in a political movement, led in all kinds of unforeseen directions. A lot of this emphasis, for example, would within 5 or 6 years galvanize the women's movement because a lot of women who had read the Port Huron Statement, went through the movement, became quite disturbed by the fact that it always seemed to be men that were leading the quest for personal authenticity and said, hold on a minute. I mean, if that's what we're really about, where are us as women in this movement? And that's really one of the intellectual origins of the women's movement, for example.
One other thing I'd like to read from this document, the SDS Manifesto, and I think this shows the discomfort that a lot of the SDS members had about their own middle-class background. The statement opens with, "We are a people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably to the world we inherit." What are the roots of this discomfort with being middle-class and being radical?
Well, there's a kind of irony here in that most of them, the only role models they had for being radical were old leftists. And so the idea that they weren't proletarian, they might intellectually and cerebrally say the proletariat is an obsolete metaphysical category, but many of them still kept thinking, well, people who are less privileged than us must have a somehow more uncorrupted moral conscience, and therefore they'll be more worthy of carrying forward a radical political movement. So there's some of that. The sentence you just read, actually, I think it comes from a period in the New Left's life when, in fact, it was actually rather candid about its middle-class roots. And I think a lot of the more outright and vociferous rejection of middle-class roots would come later, after they a number of the young organizers in 1964 and 65 had gone into the ghettos of several American cities to organize the underclass and the unemployed. And it's then that you would get a just outright denial of being children of prosperity. The sentence you read, in fact, is an admission that that's what they are. And it came to be rather chic within 3 or 4 years to pretend that you were nothing of the sort, or if you had, you would somehow shed all of these bourgeois trappings in various ways.
Well, Tom Hayden, who I think wrote that statement that I just read, had talked about how he was alienated and kind of empty in middle-class life, and then he found commitment, mm-hmm. and in finding political commitment, the emptiness fled.
Well, I think that he felt that way, and many of his peers treated him as emblematic, and they hoped that other kids who didn't come out of an old left family could have that kind of experience. Tom Hayden was one of the very few early important leaders of the New Left who didn't come from a fairly politically precocious background. He had grown up in a Catholic suburb of Detroit from a modestly sort of lower middle class background. He had been educated in very repressive Catholic schools. His heroes in the late 50s were James Dean and Alfred E. Newman. So that when he first came in contact with student activists in 1960, what excited him was here seemed to be ideas in action. Here was life lived on the edge in the name of a higher ideal. And that was a tremendously exciting discovery to him, in part because it seemed that life didn't have to be boring anymore.
My guest is James Miller. We're talking about the subject of his new book, Democracy is in the Streets, which is a history of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
James Miller is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Democracy is in the Streets, which is a history of the radical student movement of the 1960s, focusing on the early years of SDS. What would you say the goals were of SDS? We've talked a little bit about the political manifesto.
Well, some of the things you've mentioned about finding a meaning of existence and independence and personal authenticity, they summed a lot of these aspirations up into words, participatory democracy, which became the kind of catchword in which the term by which everybody thought of the Port Huron Statement. It became one of the great cliches of the 60s, that people should be given the power to make the decisions that affect their lives. It was a term that kept changing in significance as the decade wore on. At the outset, I think what they mainly had in mind was going into places like Macomb, Mississippi, where blacks were not even able to vote, and registering black voters, and if necessary, doing that by using direct action, that politics was something more than simply voting. By the mid-60s, it had come to mean something far more radical and utopian, a kind of rule by consensus in tiny little communes of people who had dispensed with all forms of hierarchy and authority. And by the end of the decade, it had come to mean, for some people, running wild in the streets. The streets belong to the people, and that kind of rhetoric.
You know, SDS was at the forefront of the most radical street demonstrations and university sit-ins, the taking over of dean's offices and president's offices, the attempted demolition of certain areas that were perceived to be supporting the war. How did SDS get from, by that I mean, actually like bombing certain school buildings that were doing war-related research. How did SDS get to from this very kind of lofty political statement to the kind of aggressive tactics that it became famous for in America?
Well, that's a rather long and tangled story, which is at the heart of the book, actually. The key, obviously, to the whole story is the Vietnam War. The New Left up until 1965 was really a tiny group of people whose existence, I think, would have been mainly noticed by people who were already in circles on the left in around universities or in New York City. For reasons that are a little bit too complex, but I go into in the book, SDS found itself coming out against the war in Vietnam very, very early, by late 1964, and as a consequence of that, found itself planning a demonstration against the war in Vietnam that became the first major march against the war in Vietnam in Washington. The march was being planned just when Lyndon Johnson began to bomb North Vietnam and escalate the war, and people who were upset about the war suddenly found there was this organization that had already made the war in Vietnam one of its big issues. The war in Vietnam almost overnight turned SDS into a mass organization, and it turned it into a mass organization just at a time when its utopian experiments with rule by consensus and direct democracy were at their peak. In other words, just at a time when it was uniquely ill-suited to be a mass movement or a mass organization. What resulted was tremendous chaos and excitement and adventure and confusion all at once. And for about 3 years, from 65 through 68, SDS and the New Left grew willy-nilly and quite amorphously as new recruits kept being poured into the movement by outrage over the war in Vietnam. People within the movement began to be quickly frustrated by the lack of what they perceived as the lack of any kind of responsiveness to these protests against the war in Vietnam. And the frustration began to translate into a kind of bitterness that perhaps some other tactics besides pacific demonstrations would have to be used. At the same time, I'd forgotten this in writing the book, but it was very striking going back and reading through the newspapers of the time. It's hard to remember how incredibly violent America became in the mid-60s, just as a general cultural phenomenon. First of all, there's the assassinations, the death of John Kennedy, and then in 1968, the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. It is a period starting in 1965 with the Watts riots and climaxing with the numerous riots that occurred after the death of Martin Luther King. It was a period of the greatest number of urban black riots and uprisings in American history, so that people who were interested in politics and in many cities, you could just look out on a summer evening and see fire in the distance. It was the time of the first television war. Vietnam was a war in which kids who had grown up thinking that America was a moral, great nation, suddenly they turned on their TV and they saw people screaming because they'd been burned by napalm. Into this rather combustible equation, add in addition drugs, because the counterculture began to take root. A lot of people in the New Left got involved in experimentation with LSD as well as marijuana, which made things even crazier. Add to this volatile mixture agents provocateurs. We now know since Watergate that the FBI was working full-time to infiltrate the various New Left and civil rights movements and try to introduce people who would foment violence to discredit the movements. And similar kinds of programs were underway in a number of cities like Los Angeles and Chicago. So I think there are a lot of reasons why things got out of control.
We mentioned Vietnam was the first television war, and in a way the civil rights movement was a television war because we saw scenes of that on our TVs every night. And then the student protests became almost like a television war because during that period you could turn on the TV and see students being tear gassed or clubbed and arrested. Do you think that a lot of people who became involved in the movement through witnessing it on television missed out on the hard political thinking that was in back of it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what happened is very ironic in that not just people who were new recruits, but some of the original leaders got terribly seduced by the fact they became television celebrities. And you could be on TV, and in fact, the more outrageous and violent thing that you did or said, the more likely you were to be on TV. Tom Hayden learned that as well as people like Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman. And there was a kind of theater of the outrageous that began to take hold among some of the older leaders and was appealing to some of the younger people. And the irony was very simply that here was a movement that in 1962 had set out to try to combat what they called mass society, to create a more honest, open, face-to-face kind of democracy, who were now communicating with anonymous masses of people through media stereotypes and thinking they were going to manipulate them and somehow come out ahead. It didn't work out that way.
SDS lost a lot of its political power base in the late 60s, certainly by the early 70s. And I think that in a way, a lot of people in the student movement started to see SDS as being slightly irrelevant and out of touch. And I wonder if you'd agree with that, and if so, why you think that happened.
Well, by 1968, most of the SDS had become a kind of little sideshow in which people were arguing in very arcane and esoteric terms, using, in fact, guess what, Marxist slogans. All the things that had been rejected 6 years earlier had made a ferocious comeback, and the first time perhaps was tragedy, this was definitely farce. And people were aware of that. I mean, why should they listen to people yell and scream about Mao Zedong or Ho Chi Minh? But I think the real turning point for the left in the 60s was 1970 in Kent State. There had been deaths of student activists before then, but as a media event, this was the first time I think it really sunk into a lot of people who had come along for the ride that, hey, you could actually get killed for believing in this fantasy. And with abrupt suddenness, the movement disappeared within a matter of months. And it also disappeared in such a way that in the minds of a lot of people, it had discredited itself.
Of course, something else that also really changed SDS was the Weather Underground, when some of the people decided to go underground and be much more violent.
Yes.
And subversive than they'd ever been. But you started this book in a way to try to figure out what the real legacy of the radical student movement was. You had some ideas before you started the book, but now your ideas are based on the years of research you put into it. How are your ideas different now than they were when you started?
Well, I find whenever I write a book that I always start thinking I'm going to find a key to a better world, and by the time I'm done, I figure that not only is it not the key, but it's probably a key to a worse world, which means that I'm done with the research on the book. And have thought it through or digested it in some way. The legacy of the New Left, though, I think lives on in kind of unobtrusive ways in the 80s. You see a lot of citizen action groups that are largely staffed by people who came through the New Left, who do either consumer-oriented stuff or environmental issues, anti-nuclear stuff. And these people are as chastened, I think, by their experience as I was by mine and then by writing the book. And they have attempted to try to digest the lessons of the 60s, apply them in practice, and keep alive the hope of creating some more democratic kind of society in the United States. And I must say that, you know, in this day and age of Oliver North and Iran-Contra, the idea that the United States should look long and hard at what its democratic institutions are still has a real resonance.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been James Miller, who's the author of the new book, Democracy is in the Streets. It's a history of SDS and the radical student movement of the 1960s. It's published by Simon & Schuster. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ralph Allen, creator of the musical Sugar Babies, and he's also an expert on burlesque, so I hope you can join us.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in a mile.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, humorist Alice Kahn talks about life during the age of the yuppie. Yuppie is a word Kahn is either credited with or blamed for creating. Her new collection of essays is titled My Life as a Gal. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews Digital Duke, the new album featuring some of Duke Ellington's best-known songs, recorded on state-of-the-art equipment. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at the network's live coverage of the Iran-Contra hearings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of a new album of Duke Ellington compositions, with Duke's son Mercer conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra. The album features some of Ellington's best-known songs, recorded with state-of-the-art technology.
Digital Duke, a new release on GRP Records, is the jazz version of what the Hollywood wags call high concept. High concept is what you have when the reasons for making a movie and the strategy for marketing it are one and the same. So how is Digital Duke high concept? Well, consider the title. It's the album's strongest selling point. Digital Duke, Duke Ellington's greatest hits in state-of-the-art 32-track digital sound. Never mind that it's debatable whether 32-track recording is the ideal method for capturing the sound of a 15-piece big band. This is an album tailor-made for the new breed of jazz audiophile spawned by the conjugation of digital sound and the compact disc. Is the album any good? Yes, very. The Duke Ellington Orchestra, under the direction of Ellington's son Mercer, remains a splendid big band, and needless to say, Duke left Mercer the best of all possible repertoires. For this album, Mercer Ellington has welcomed back such distinguished Ellington alumni as trumpeter Clark Terry, trombonist Britt Woodman, and drummer Louis Belson. Mercer has also loaded the orchestra with a dazzling array of guest soloists, including pianist Roland Hanna, clarinetist Eddie Daniels, and tenor saxophonist Branford Marsalis. There are fine interpretations of Satin Doll, Cottontail, Prelude to a Kiss, Perdido, Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and Take the A-Train, to say nothing of the four bonus tracks included only on the compact disc. So Digital Duke is an excellent record on its own terms, but does it succeed in conjuring up Duke Ellington? That's a thorny question, and I'll answer it by saying this. The only track that really takes off is a blues that Duke Ellington originally titled Slammer in D-flat. The liner notes reveal that Ellington recorded it under that title, but that the session was never released. Mercer Ellington renamed it 22 Cent Stomp last year when the U.S. Post Office issued a commemorative stamp bearing his father's likeness. I think this track owes a great deal of its charm to the opening solos by Roland Hanna and Clark Terry, which we're going to hear, and to the solos that follow by trombonist Al Gray and trumpeter Barry Lee Hall, which we won't have time for. But an even greater factor in the success of 22 Cent Stomp might be the absence of a definitive interpretation by the composer to measure it against. Thank you. 22-cent Stomp by the Duke Ellington Orchestra, conducted by Mercer Ellington, from the album Digital Duke, an album I'm extremely ambivalent about. On the one hand, Digital Duke is an album that one can listen to with pleasure from start to finish, and those are becoming extremely rare. But the album says something about Ellington that everybody already knows, that he was a great songwriter and bandleader. What needs saying is that he was also Charles Ives's only serious competition as the greatest 20th century American composer. Since Ellington's death in 1974, Mercer Ellington has conducted many of his father's longer works and valiantly blown the cobwebs off of the three-minute masterpieces that Duke recorded in the 20s and 30s and neglected in later years. But record companies invariably want new versions of Ellington's greatest hits when they bring Mercer and the band into the studio. In a nutshell, that's my problem with Digital Duke. It gives us luxurious new versions of songs every devoted jazz fan already knows by heart. But with so much essential Ellington in danger of falling by the wayside, new versions of Satin Doll and Take the A-Train are luxuries we can live without.
Jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Digital Duke with Mercer Ellington conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. My guest is humorist Alice Kahn. Her twice-a-weekly column in the San Francisco Chronicle is part satire, part social commentary, and part memoir. Kahn's new book is a collection of columns titled My Life as a Gal. Her subjects range from her prom night to the gentrification of her neighborhood. In fact, Alice Kahn is credited with inventing the term yuppie. I asked her how she came up with it.
Well, I was sitting in my room in my gentrified neighborhood in North Berkeley, California, and thinking about what happened that made all the shoe repairs disappear and caused five cappuccino cafes to open up in a two-square block area in a two-month period. And I thought, well, there's been this invasion of young urban types. And I had seen a cartoon in The New Yorker by Roz Chast called Attack of the Young Professionals. And I thought, yes, it's happened here. And I was going through the chronology of the generation from hippie to yippie. And finally, you know, it just seemed yuppie was the perfect cute little word that got at the essence of this type.
Well, you've updated your writing about yuppies, and you wrote an article called Where Have All the Yuppies Gone? And you imply that babies are changing the yuppie lifestyle. How is the presence of babies changing the lives of yuppies?
Well, right away they leave fingerprints on the furniture, which is, you know, a real destroyer to the... There's sort of a stage set quality to the young urban professional's lifestyle that children are messy and they mess things up both psychologically, emotionally, in a very nice way. I mean, I think people should be messed up. Babies do have this terrible way of humanizing people. I ran into a friend of mine, a psychotherapist, who read that essay and told me how true it was that her children had humanized her. And I said to her, somewhat jokingly, and I'm sure you would have rather stayed a bitch. And she knew what I meant. You know, it's nobody will give up their perfections unless forced to. And babies are a much nicer way of being forced to than, say, death and dying and aging and the nasty way life changes us.
But Alice, on the one hand, you say that babies are humanizing yuppies, but on the other hand, you fear that babies are just the latest consumer fad.
Well, I think a lot of people got into babies in the same way they got into cocaine or into their careers or into any number of things. You know, at some point when people got into babies, they discovered that they were a little harder to get out of. And I have a sort of tongue-in-cheek essay on the effect of children on the yuppies in the book called How to Raise a Perfect Chump, Children of Upwardly Mobile Professionals. But it's really definitely having a profound change. And it's really splitting the generation in a way it's never been split, even by class lines, into parents and non-parents. And I don't think we've seen the full extent of that. But to some degree, we're seeing it in the concern over neighborhood and community of the parents versus the interest in more new developments, new stores, new activity in have-not children group.
When you were in kindergarten, you once listed your ambition as to be a writer, but you never really pursued it as an adult until you were the mother of two, and I think in your late 30s. Why did you wait so long until you started to write professionally?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Part of it has to do with the fact that I grew up as a girl, and I never thought about what I was going to do for money when I grew up. I thought about what I was going to do to satisfy myself, and I wanted to be a poet, and I wrote poems. And then I graduated from college, and I looked in the want ads under poet, and, you know, there wasn't like a long list for them. But around the time I might have become a writer, which was the late 60s, I became involved in sort of this political attitude of the time, which was that the world was coming to an end. The Vietnam War was going to result in, if not nuclear annihilation, revolution at home. And the arts seemed irrelevant at the time. So I became a nurse. I was going to be a war nurse. You know, I'd seen all those Ann Sheridan 1940s movies. And that was sort of my fantasy. And I got involved in the free clinic movement of the time and the women's health movement and sort of went through that whole thing. And once I was safely ensconced in my role as the, you know, angel of mercy nurse, then I could sort of act out the naughty, wild need for creativity side in writing. And around this time, which was about 5 years ago, I discovered that there was this whole series of alternative press papers in the country. You know, there's one in almost every city. Every place where there's a cappuccino machine and a futon shop has a free or cheap alternative press, which has some, you know, amazingly loose, experimental, interesting writing. And that's where I found I could sort of let myself go.
So by funding the alternative press, you were able to be politically correct and write at the same time.
Or even have fun with being politically incorrect and seeing what that provoked. That was probably the most interesting. And in fact, that yuppie piece got an incredible number of angry letters, just hysterical letters that were self-satires, letters from people saying things like, "How dare you make fun of people who eat croissants?"
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I really ought to ask you if you ever considered yourself to be a yuppie, because you never meet anybody who says that they feel that they're a yuppie. It's always the other person.
I think it has some, you know, did I ever consider myself a yuppie? I'd say a yuppie wannabe was sort of my fantasy. When I was in college and I was going to Columbia University and I was going to be a mad poetess, but then at night I had this little running serial in my mind. I would go to sleep, but I wouldn't fall asleep. I'd stay up all night because I was an insomniac. And I'd have this continuing serial where I'd move to an elevated building on the east side of New York and I'd, you know, look perfect all the time, and I'd have this wonderfully designed apartment, and I don't know what I'd go off and do, but somehow I'd come home in the evening and have, you know, dinner and wine, and everything would be just so fine and so delightful. But sure, I'm as upwardly mobile as the next guy.
It's interesting that you have maintained your marriage for, was it over 20 years now?
And you've On August 14th, it'll be 21 years, yeah.
That's a long time, and you've been through a lot of changes in your life since you were mm-hmm. married, and I should mention you married your high school sweetheart.
We went to the prom together, yes.
Now, I should also mention that sometime, and I guess in the late 60s or something, you threw out your wedding album because you were slightly embarrassed by it.
Yes, I burned it in what I call the bourgeois purges of the Maoist period, which I'm terribly, you know, just last week I said, oh, I wish I had that wedding album. But that's okay. The snapshots are in my head. You know, I can still see, you know, great grandma Rose wandering through the synagogue, and I can still see the guests eating up all the crab mousse before we got to it. And it was a terrific day, the day of my wedding. I had a great time.
You've divided a woman's life into three stages: girlhood, galhood, and old girlhood. And you are entering the stage now of old girlhood, yes?
Although I look great, I just, you know, I think the listeners ought to know that, you know, we're being tongue-in-cheek about old girlhood because, in fact, I wrote a column for my newspaper column in the Chronicle. I wrote a column called I'm Old, Fat, and Ugly. And after that, everybody who met me said, you're not old, fat, and ugly. And I said, well, I guess that was what I wanted to hear. I guess I needed that.
You started writing in the alternative press. You now have your column in the San Francisco Chronicle. What has it been like for you to write about such personal things in such a public place?
It's made me feel like some kind of pervert who has to expose herself, but it's also made me feel like I have these friends, just like I wanted when I wrote to my pen pals and when I was a kid. People meet me, they know all about me, and now then it's just my job to ask about them. And I've laid my cards on the table, so I feel it makes interviewing people a lot easier.
At the beginning of your book, you say, why else am I slaving over a hot disk drive except for your affection? And do you really think that's why you write?
Absolutely. I want to be a popular kid.
Alice Kahn, thanks a lot for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Alice Kahn's new book is called My Life as a Gal. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Terry, tonight in our coverage of the Iran-Contra hearings, we take a look at how the hearings are playing in Central America. Also, on a lighter note, we visited a salon in Georgetown today. The man who does Nancy Reagan's hair, Robin Weir, says he's having something of a run on requests for Oliver North haircuts this week. And this evening, I'm speaking to a man in Los Angeles who tomorrow will drive the last 4 miles of a million miles that he's put on his Volkswagen, a 20-year-old car.
Doing better than my car. Thanks. Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At work or at home, many of us have been carefully monitoring the congressional hearings on the Iran-Contra affair. Our television critic David Bianculli has these thoughts on the network's live coverage of the hearings.
Since May, like most people, I've been watching the Iran-Contra hearings off and on. Last week, though, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North took the stand instead of the fifth, and I watched on and on. I've been addicted, and I'm not alone. The ratings for North's testimony have been 10% higher than the soap operas and game shows he's preempting. The networks, which up to now have been pretty fickle about covering the hearings live, were there all last week. And no wonder. Television doesn't get much more interesting or important than the Iran-Contra hearings. NBC's Tom Brokaw has called it, quote, mentally draining and utterly fascinating, unquote. And he's right on both counts. North is a sharp and literate witness. Even when his testimony isn't impressive, his grammar is. And he's got a feisty, funny lawyer in Brendan Sullivan. The committee chairman and lawyers and members have all been scoring points, too, and the whole thing is as much like a prize fight as a congressional hearing. It's like the Ali Frazier thriller in Manila, with both sides bobbing and weaving, looking for openings, taking their best shots, standing toe-to-toe, and, on occasion, landing a good one. I like to think of it as the raucous in the caucus. Here's one of my favorite exchanges. Sullivan, North's lawyer, is speaking to Senator Daniel Inouye, chairman of the Senate Investigation Committee.
I'm just asking for fairness. Fairness. I know the rules don't apply. I know the Congress doesn't recognize attorney-client privilege, husband and wife privilege, priest-penitent privilege. I know those things are all out
the
window.
We have attempted
rely on just fairness, Mr. Chairman. Fairness.
The witness object if he wishes to.
Well, sir, I'm not a potted plant. I'm here as the lawyer. That's my job.
I could watch this stuff all day. And I have been, monitoring many TV sets at the same time. Even though all the networks share the same three-camera pool coverage of the hearings, each network has been covering North's testimony a bit differently. The cable news network and ABC get the highest marks for using TV to enhance the testimony rather than just relay it. Whenever there's a particularly complex question or answer that refers to a background player or organization, CNN and ABC shrink the picture a bit to make room for superimposed sentences or explanatory material. ABC, which has a name for everything, calls these things data banks. When I was a kid, my teachers called them visual aids. CNN doesn't call them anything. The point is, they really help to explain when Lake Resources was formed or when John Poindexter resigned as National Security Advisor without interrupting the question and answer session. CBS and NBC provide much of the same information, but do it verbally, not visually, which is kind of stupid. I have no complaints with what Tom Brokaw or CBS's Dan Rather are saying, just with when they say it. They often drown out the testimony they're covering. And I have another complaint about Rather. For some reason, he feels compelled to fill even the most dramatic silences. Those times when a tough question is asked and North and Sullivan are whispering to each other, settling on an answer. Often, while NBC, ABC, PBS, and CNN are silent, CBS's Rather is saying something like, "This really gets to the heart of it," instead of letting the drama speak for itself. Sports announcers, the best ones, know when to keep quiet. Rather seems to think he's on the radio.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with photographer Tony Mendoza. His new book, Stories, is an autobiography in words and pictures. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile rockabilly guitarist Sonny Burgess. And book critic John Leonard will review The Rat, the new book by Gunter Grass. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landerl, with producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, additional assistance from Lisa Bruton, research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.